especially to from those who are involved in service delivery, so that we can begin to highlight some of those challenges with the department and together work out some possible solutions of how to overcome that. Now, we advertised for this and we had hoped that we would get substantial responses. We did so at a significant cost. This time around, instead of approaching specific organizations, we opened it up altogether and we said, let anybody who wants to come forward, make a submission and make themselves available. Unfortunately, we only got about 3 responses. We tried after realizing that we had few responses to try and get more people to participate, more organizations. We approached, for example, the People's Budget, DASA, and Angoko. I don't know if the UNDP was approached. UNDP as well. We tried them, and all of them were committed elsewhere. Hopefully next year things will be better, and I think maybe the best thing next year, instead of spending 32,000 rand on an advert, is to rather target those organizations who we think will be able to add value. But we have the Black Sash this morning. We also have
UNICEF, but they are running late for the class.
Oh, that's fine. We will have UNICEF later, and then we thought after the budget hearings, we would then use the balance of the time to deal with the community program. I may also have to go out briefly to meet with the chief whip because there are issues relating to our overseas study tour. There is a feeling that we're having this in the middle of dealing with urgent legislation and that we shouldn't use our limited time to focus on anything else except the trip. I think there's no full appreciation of the fact that the trip is directly linked to the actual processing of the bill. But yeah, we're still going to engage in those battles, and I hope you'll wish me luck as I do battle with the powers that be over that matter. All right, without waste of any further time, let me hand over to the Black Sash. I think they will introduce themselves and kick off. It's a free, it's an open field, so be at your best. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Chair Mike Masuta. My name is Elroy Polis. I work for the Black Sash. Many of you may know the organization as being around for more than 50 years. We've made a detailed submission, but before we get into the nitty-gritties of it, I wish to extend our appreciation to the committee for making the space available. Thank you very much. And I have to acknowledge the presence of a colleague. With me is Ms. Leonie Caroline. She's the regional director for the Cape Town Regional Office. So just a little bit about the Black Sash. We are an organization that has a very interesting strategic plan for 2008 and beyond. Those of you who know a little bit about the organization, since the 50s it was involved in advocacy, advocating for legislation and policy promoting social and consumer protection for vulnerable members of the South African population. We are involved in rights education, which is a core thrust of our work, more so than other strategies, in providing knowledge which enables the public to access social and consumer protection. Historically, the 7 regional offices, namely Cape Town, Knysna, Grahamstown, Pietermaritzburg, Port Elizabeth, Durban, and Gauteng, engage with individuals and more with groups to help them exercise their socioeconomic rights as prescribed by South African law. We have a very detailed information management system which increasingly reflects interesting trends, patterns, helps us get insights. Since the period 2003, we have served more than 58,000 people, not necessarily individuals, but people with cases. So one person may have more than one case. And in 2007, we helped recover 9.7 million to these individual beneficiaries in government grants, private pensions, social security queries. And in the process, we have assisted our clients to recover their rights to the recognition of their dignity and humanity. The two photographs here is around project, which I'm going to talk to very briefly. The bottom left picture are the caseworkers, paralegals, and administrator of the Cape Town Regional Office helping respondents prepare an affidavit for a Cape High Court case preventing the farm owner from evicting them because of the disputes about whether ESTA or the prevention of illegal occupation and unlawful eviction applies. So more and more we are engaging with communities at the local level. Very briefly, rights education and advocacy is cross-cutting across three programs. The first program is around helping promote comprehensive social protection in its widest interpretation, consumer protection for the poor, and the one I alluded to, making human rights real in the marginalized communities at the local level, and helping to establish accountable local governance for effective social protection. There are hard copies of this available, and I will make the PowerPoint presentation that speaks to the written submission also available immediately after the submission. So, coming to the content of our submission, we know in the 2008 budget speech of the Minister of Finance that he alludes to turbulent times. But at the same time, our take on it is that it is a disproportionate hardship for the poor. Many initiatives have been taken that provide succor and a buffer for, most importantly, ESCOM with its current challenges. Tax relief for people who have higher income earning, people who pay as you earn. As part of the People's Budget campaign, one of the things we asked for years was an increase in the tax to GDP ratio above 25%. It is that now for more than 3 years, but at the same time, the recommendations of the People's Budget campaign talks. The title for the 2009-10 financial year is entitled Budgeting for Poverty and Inequality in the Midst of a Surplus. Now, there's a lot of arguments about whether the surplus is a wise thing or not. There are different interpretations to it. We certainly have one, which we're not going to get into right now. But be that as it may, we believe that the minister correctly identified the problem, rising interest rates, food and fuel prices, causing discomfort and hardship, the ever-increasing proposed increase in rates for electricity. You know too well what we're talking about. However, we are of the view, respectfully, that an accurate description of the problems doesn't guarantee the formulation of an appropriate solution. And hopefully, our engagement with this committee today, and hopefully in the near future, would help to unpack exactly what this means to the South African scenario, demographics of poverty, and the unique challenges facing us. So we also view that the existing interventions by the state, they're significant. Nobody contests the fact that no government in the history of South Africa has ever made such significant interventions. We respectfully are of the view that to address the chronic nature of the problem unemployment inequality in South Africa, that these interventions are less than adequate. And we are concerned that it may fail to arrest the widening of national imbalances. In other words, the trajectory of the Gini coefficient, despite the significant interventions. Government admits that the Gini coefficient at the moment is 0.72, and there are debates raging as to whether the social transfers have reduced this number or has prevented it from going up. The minister again says it continues to remain high between social groups. But we differ with the assertion that because of the description of the turbulent times, we are all in this together. Very respectfully, we differ with that. A few years ago, when Minister Vali Musa was in Environmental Affairs and Tourism, they published a picture in the front cover on disaster management. And in it, the picture describes the situation. There's a storm coming on the horizon, and there's a huge ship with many lifeboats, and next to it are people in a small boat. We're facing the same storm, but our vulnerability is much greater. And that's the constituency we work with. That's the group of people. That's LSM 1 to 5 who crosses the threshold of our regional offices on a daily basis. And so there are some interesting statements, if you unpack it, reflect a more serious problem. For example, during the course of 2007, the minister said, food prices increased by over 10%. Now, if one is to assume that the 12 rand increase in millimeal over a period of 2 years, which he alludes to, changes from by an increase, it's not just 10%. If you take that 12 rand per annum increase in millimeal, the nominal average annual increase in this staple food is 16%. In other words, 60% above the average food price increase of 10%. So we are extremely concerned that comments may generalize specific issues. The average inflation rate, as we know, is now between 8 and 9%. But the extent to which the inflation for food and transport contributes to that average figure is one that we are critically aware of. We also believe that the negative impact of recent global financial developments on all of us, it does affect us. And daily we read what's happening on the effects of the financial problems in the U.S. affecting the global market. But it, in our view, most seriously affects the poor. And that the adjustments to the social grants for this financial year are inadequate. Therefore, we see tax deductions and corporate leniency. Right now, in Committee Room 1, the Competition Commission is making a submission with regards to a review of their work and proposing what should change in order to strengthen the teeth of the Competition Commission, amongst other things. A few months ago, the Black Sash, along with other civil society partners, made a submission to the Competition Commission on a bread price fixing scandal. And we made several strong recommendations to prevent corporate leniency from being applied. Those of you who are not aware of it, corporate leniency is a policy in the Competition Commission wanting the guilty parties to confess. And when they confess, they get a reduction on the fine that was due to them. So in the case of Premier Foods, it was 5% of turnover. That's where the 99 million comes in. But it subsequently showed that they are 100% owners of pharmaceutical companies that are involved by their confession in collusion and price fixing on the intravenous needles bought by the state. And so the question that one asks is it fair to give these kinds of companies that are guilty of nefarious and, in our view, what should be criminally prosecutable offenses, should they be given corporate leniency or should there be greater discretion? And at the same time, that kind of tax deductions and relief in the face of turbulent times doesn't accord with the same weight to poor people. We are we participated in the hearings, as I mentioned, and the reasons why we feel so strongly about it and mentioning it to the Portfolio Committee on Social Development is that the effect of bread price increases, this 40 cents per loaf recently, does have a very negative impact on people in living standard measures 1 to 5, people affected who are classified indigent. But at the same time, honorable members, the problem is that this level of nefarious practices by large businesses has a direct effect on the purchasing power of people living in great poverty, recipients of grants. But at the same time, consumers in higher living standard measures, because of these circumstances described, fall upon hard times and eventually become dependent on social protection. those people who were able to fend for themselves, as a result of all these foreseen and unforeseeable consequences, fall upon the state to support them if this kind of practice is left unchecked. In other words, to what extent does the, and people would know that immediately after the fine was imposed, very shortly afterward, there was this increase in 40 cents per loaf of bread. Now the question is, who eventually pays for the fine? Is it the state? Especially for people who buy bread and are entirely dependent on social grants. Because that increase takes away the disposable income, the much needed income to feed children, and goes back to the coffers of large businesses. That is something that really worries us. And this we see it most clearly within the Black Sash, because we serve people largely seeking social protection. But we also last year launched the guide of the paralegal guide on debt and credit, which was the culmination of serious engagement around the National Credit Act. And we see an interconnectedness between people seeking consumer protection and those seeking social protection. Which way is the trajectory going? Will people in LSM 6 to 10 one day fall upon hard times and be in 1 to 5 and therefore depend on the state for intervention? We hope that the work of this committee, the Department of Social Development, becomes critical and promotes intergovernmental and parliamentary relations. It is increasingly important for the reasons described above, and that comprehensive social security and protection must be maintained in its most broad sense. And we hope to engage the committee at a future date on this issue. When the President in his State of the Nation address spoke about the 24 apex priorities, we wish to state that we affirm this increase in public spending by government, but respectfully differ in the weighting of the apex priorities. We are of the view that it's too infrastructure oriented and fails to address an even more important in national emergency, which I'll come to there's a graphic description of what I'm trying to explain, namely unemployment and inequality. We are concerned that the fundamental assumption underpinning the intervention is based on solely economic growth. Yes, we do want growth to address the many challenges facing our country, but to what extent does the growth path ensure distribution of wealth? Selective, limited interventions in social security and essential services, in our view, too slowly addresses issues of chronic poverty in South Africa. And quite frankly, the view expressed by the Treasury on this matter, in terms of the interventions made, are either naive at best, and at worst, realizing the problems, but refusing to reprioritize resources it does have to address this national emergency. We believe that significant resources are allocated, but not sufficient to address this crisis. By any comparison, if you list countries in the world, from the one with the highest GDP to the lowest, there would be about 180 countries in the world. We fall along the middle line as a middle income country. We fall in the band associated with countries like Brazil. Now, if you compare countries in that category, we have the highest unemployment rate, whether by narrow or expanded definition. We have income inequality that is either the highest or amongst the highest in the world, and the unique profile of the different aspects of poverty. Those of us around long enough who knows about the recommendations of the Taylor Committee report, they define poverty in different ways. There's income poverty, which is the one that comes closest to our mind and is understood immediately and most easily, but there are aspects of capability, asset, and chronic poverty that must be understood correctly before interventions are made by the state. And this profile of poverty is for us a most serious long-standing national emergency, one that demands unusual measures. Over and above this, the debilitating effects of HIV/AIDS in Southern Africa, the high levels of financial illiteracy, the inability to save, and the poor culture of saving other income categories, and very low savings ratios aggravate our vulnerability. Our chances of recovery is worsened by a range of negative developments and cannot be improved without significant state-led interventions. Now, honorable members, at the risk of sounding like a stuck record, I think this issue, which is going to be demonstrated in a diagram, is so fundamental, I wish to underscore its importance. And so, you would know that 1 in 4 adults, by conservative estimates, are unemployed, and many of these are parents with no form of income support and unable to access jobs or find work through the EPWPs. The Minister, Toko Didiza, herself has acknowledged that the jobs, namely 854,460, are temporary in nature and has a low margin for skills transfer. We quote her extensively in our written submission. The additional allocations of 12 billion for social grants over the MTEF period are significant and, again, respectfully, not sufficient because of the severity of unemployment, poverty, and inequality, and that it demands more resources and a bolder, more integrated approach. And so that 12 billion over the MTEF period, if we monitor it and look at the allocations, it remains 3.3% of our GDP on non-contributory grants. In other words, the number may get bigger, but the proportion of the GDP remains the same, which we believe is not a good idea and should increase. The allocations are limited and compares insufficiently to the tax subsidies and incentives given this year alone to higher income earning individuals and companies. And this gaping hole that I speak of, and I'm going to skip the slide, is best illustrated. Alex van der Heuvel at the International Conference for Social Development, this is one of these diagrams, and I hope to spend a few minutes on this, because if you look at the marker, the graph demonstrates on the right females, on the left males, the age profile. Most of our young people, of our population, are in the age cohort 5 to 9 up to 25 to 29. And this here are our young people. Now, this box that circumscribes the age category 18 up to 65, we would consider to be the active population, the economically active population in our country. These are men and women who have access to work. Now, the interventions and the construction of social grants makes the assumption that this hole called the unemployed and the working poor is smaller, much smaller. Just to put things in context, Brazil has an unemployment rate of 9.7% by narrow definition. And they call that an emergency. They call that a crisis. Now,
Mola, as in signs or...
The area of the circle within the box. Yeah. I'm describing, Chairperson, the size of this hole within the economically active population. Now, the consequences of the size of this hole is that because our economically active population are unemployed and poor, and you know that this is a generalization that effectively means nothing. You go to Laingsburg or Tofenvaba, and that hole is much bigger. It would be 75% up in some rural towns. You would know that. So that is an average representation.
But the hole represents those who are actually not active economically active. Age code.
Correct. Thank you for the clarification. Now, if you would view this as a sticker that one places on top of that red box, then parts of that sticker are stickier than others. In other words, within the bottom part of that circle, the extent of the unemployment is far more chronic. You would know that Stats SA revealed that young people, despite increases in skills, are not taken up in the economically active formal working sector. Now, I think the important thing is that whole has a series of problematic consequences. Our grandmothers who get that 940 with the increases, they keep these young people alive. They do not use that 900 odd rand for themselves. They use it to keep families alive. Honorable members, you know that that's a painful reality. You know that...
Can I just interject you? Because, you see, as you correctly say, that the irony of this is that that young age cohort consists of young people who actually have training but are not being absorbed in the labor market. And maybe at some point we need to zoom into that, and maybe you might just want to spend some time at a certain point with us, because I personally feel that we need to interrogate this question. Because if the challenge is that South Africa does not have the appropriate needed skill that the economy requires, hence that accounts for in large measure for the unemployment problem, then the question becomes, but why are these young people with skills not being absorbed? Especially if you take this publicly announced 40% vacancy rate in the public service. I don't know what the vacancy rate is within the private sector, if there is one. But we'll come back to some of those issues. Sorry for interjecting.
Not at all. Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to accept the invitation to engage this further. If I were to respond immediately to you, I think your concern is underscored by the fact that the economic growth rate should more closely, and as Gisa outlines this, the need for the growth path to be more labor intensive. Personally, I'm concerned that the nature of our growth path, the 4.5% that is alluded to, has largely been in the finance sector. Now, given global development, the question is how will that negatively, to what extent will they negatively affect our growth rate? Because the uptake in the increase in growth has been largely alluded to come from the financial sector. And so the extent to which the growth path is linked to labor-intensive, quality, skilled job uptake compared to it being capital-intensive or temporary in nature is a debate that should rage in Parliament and is linked to the National Industrial Policy, the work of the Competition Commission happening right now, and other committees that I believe should urgently interact with this committee to see those linkages. I say that respectfully. The complicating factor is that some of the economically active population choose to leave formal jobs to look after family members who are dying because of the consequences of HIV. I also think that this diagram describes how the allocation of grants goes to sustain families rather than individuals it is intended for. Now, by no means is that perverse. That is selfless. I think it demonstrates the giving nature of South African citizens who, especially mothers, would die for their children and make ultimate sacrifices. I think that's an important diagram to use as a reference point in our argument. Now, in light of that important diagram, Chairperson, we find that the response to the call for the extension of grants by the Treasury has been disappointing. We commend the decision to equalize the state old age pension, the necessary move towards gender equality and increasing the dignity of life for vulnerable men. But we are concerned that it is slow and incremental, only to be fully realized by 2010. We're disappointed that the Finance Minister failed to realize the constitutional rights of all our children by limiting the extension of the child support grant to 15 as from January 2009. The budget once again failed to realize the rights of children embodied in our constitution, that they be protected and supported until the age of 18. And clearly the definition of a child in Section 28.3, Chapter 2, the Bill of Rights, Section 27.1, describing the child to be included in having the right to access to Social Security, including if they are unable to support themselves and their dependents and have appropriate social assistance. And the definition of the child, very importantly, is up to the age of 18. I underscore that because the Minister of Finance, in a recent NEDLAC EXCO meeting, 2008, and in the Mahlangu case, alludes to a different understanding of what constitutes or who is defined as a child. Now, I know in the room there are people who are far more qualified than us and who have engaged this committee, namely the Children's Institute, on these matters. And so we are concerned that children who are at a particularly vulnerable phase in their life cannot afford to wait for this slow rollout for the extension of the child support grant. South African children between the ages of 15 and 18 remain in jeopardy as a result of this decision, and the consequences of the neglect will be felt for generations to come. Chairperson, I need to say that a year ago, you heard very eloquent arguments, for example, by UNICEF, about whether the priority to chase numbers, you know, the 3.9 million beneficiaries jumping to 12.4, as commendable as that is, that is largely due to the child support grant. Now, we're not negating the progressive rollout of those grants that cost billions. What we are concerned about is whether that intervention significantly addresses the progress measured not only by numbers, not only numerically, but by development indicators, such as the Human Development Index, the infant mortality rate, the maternal mortality rate. And they respectfully made recommendations that 4 to 5 times more resources be set aside to intervene and more robustly, aggressively be targeted to the realization of the Millennium Development Goals. Now, last night, I attended the launch of the South African Child Gauge, and in the room is Ms. Paula Proudlock, who has engaged this committee extensively. And this book, we endorse and commend the work that the Children's Institute has done. And these figures contained here demonstrate the kinds of numbers that we and parameters and criteria for measuring progress that must be almost more important than mere nominal figures, which thus far has not been used in the most, I'm wanting to be kind, progressive way by particularly the National Treasury. We can measure progress differently, Chairperson. And when it comes to the health of children, we endorse the children's gauge and suggest that the committee engage in this in a robust way in the future. So this and other studies have begun to challenge some allusions made that people sometimes seek to acquire grants in a perverse manner. There was the statement made that teenage girls fall pregnant in order to acquire a child support fund. Now, I'm sure that a few people actually do that. But to generalize and make that an accusation applicable to everybody is quite frankly offensive. And the HSRC has done a detailed study to show that school dropout is a cause and not a result of teenage pregnancy. We are concerned that the neglect of a crucial group of teenagers will perpetuate poverty cycles into the next generation. And therefore, Chairperson, we with muted applause, commend the review of eligibility criteria only insofar as that it would expand the Social Security net, not restrict it. We don't need an approach that has a reductionist mindset on what would need to happen to make comprehensive Social Security more progressive. In fact, in the Cape Times yesterday, Minister Skweyiya alluded to the same thing, that the review of the means test should expand the social security net, not reduce it. And so other factors such as school attendance and healthcare are important, but we need to see the details before we can comment on it. This criteria has the potential, when we have a reductionist approach to means testing, to exclude many more poor and marginalized children from the grant unless the government guarantees access to and the efficient delivery of free schooling and basic medical care, as well as the presence of an able adult caretaker. And this is where the foster care grant becomes so important as well. Young people should not be denied.
Okay, at some point, I think you're going to need to elaborate on the qualitative versus quantitative approach to assessing the effect of rolling out the grant, because I'm not sure whether you've found it has not been shown to make a significant impact on the human development index. Because in my speech, for example, yesterday, I alluded to what that seems to be suggesting, that the income transfers through social assistance account for the bulk of household expenditure in poor households. Now, if that be so, doesn't it go to show that therefore it is bound to have had a profound impact on reducing the effect of poverty, such as poor nutrition, etc., etc.? So you may need to elaborate. Maybe you're saying that the amounts are not sufficient. I'm not sure whether that's what you're saying, that more could be done, but I'm not sure whether you're equally saying that the impact that is being made currently is not of a significant nature. Maybe you'll need to elaborate, especially around the child support grant.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to do that briefly here, and hopefully at a future occasion as well. I think that the engagement by professional researchers such as those in the Children's Institute, along with us, would like to engage with you on the measurement of impact, particularly using different tools, and we welcome that. Thank you. We are saying that the modest increase in the social grants does not take into account the cost of raising a child and the impact of food and food price increases on the poor. We are saying that the 10% increase of the CSG from 210 to 220, staggered over a period in between maybe 210, will not help poor families to stay on top of increasing food and fuel prices. And it hardly keeps up with the average CPI index of around 8.8% at the time of writing, and increases in the fuel levy of an extra 6 cents a litre over and above the most recent one. I think it was about 60 cents, as predicted by the budget speech. You see, Chairperson, one of the things that we should never forget, and I'm sure is in the minds of people, but we don't write about it enough, is that those social grants are also negatively affected by the persistence of spatial apartheid geography. Now, we are 13, 14 years post-apartheid, but if you go to any big city in the world, you would find your favelas and your urban poor around the central business district. The persistence of spatial geography, sometimes it has been demonstrated in research, chews up especially people who are wholly dependent on social grants. In fact, there was a paper done in KwaZulu-Natal that shows that the uptake of people seeking jobs is related to the distance of the pay point. And we would gladly forward that paper to you as well and discuss it. Moving on, because of this less than adequate increase in the CSG, mothers now have to pay more to take their children to clinics, schools, and shopping facilities in the central business districts far from their homes. The means test review, if this view results in increasing restrictions, it will continue to act as a barrier for those who do not qualify, who struggle to prove their eligibility due to circumstances beyond their control. One typical example is that in our casework, we would find people in peripheral areas, even within our metro, who have lost their ID, for example, due to a check fire. Their income is so low that they cannot go to the place where they need to apply for a new one. That's the extent of the poverty that we as the Black Sash have to deal with on a face-to-face basis, almost on a daily level. One of the grants, if we look at the table, I'm jumping two slides, the one on the vote 16 allocation of social grants, right at the bottom, chairperson, is a grant called Relief of Stress. We call it SHROD, but I was told that the Department of Social Development calls it the SRD, Social Relief of Stress Grant. Now, why that's important is that in that table, we will see that 99.1% of the resources, and they are significant, provides for income support to the elderly, the disabled, and children in need through social assistance grants as provided in law, as well as to assess the social, economic, and fiscal impact of social protection programs, and that the mandate is to reduce poverty and vulnerability of this section of our community that are in distress. Now, one of the things that we are disappointed at is that the interpretation of the instruction to attain a comprehensive social security system was interpreted in a very conservative manner for reasons I've highlighted earlier by the National Treasury. And organizations like Access will call on Minister Manuel's colleagues in the Department of Social Development to make supportive measures, including SHROD, the SHROD award, more readily available to adults and children so as not to penalize those continue to live in poverty. But here's the problem. The problem is that in the current financial year, only 124 million has been allocated. And clearly, there's going to be a lot of noise about that having to be much more. I also think that for the Black Sash, why this is such an important grant is because many of our clients who visit our regional offices are often unable to access a grant for a host of reasons. One typical scenario I mentioned before is under disaster when they are unable to prove their identity. Another example is when clients have to wait for a response from Home Affairs for key documents. In some regions, the service from Home Affairs is very poor. The SRD is a critical stopgap measure for particularly vulnerable group of people, and we are disappointed about the very small amount of money set aside for this critical grant. So we will be advocating for the finalization of progressive regulations for SRD as contained in the Social Assistance Act. When we liaised with senior officials within the Department of Social Development, we heard that this disappointingly is not coming to Parliament because of its tight schedule this year. However, we are encouraged to read about who qualifies for it in the latest DPSA presentation, Know Your Service Rights, in which the criteria for qualifying for an SRD seem to be far more progressive than our understanding, including people who are seeking work and haven't been employed for 3 to 6 months. Now that's very interesting, and we want to bring it to your attention and hope to engage with you on that at a future time. So we were pleasantly surprised at what criteria DPSA sees as applicable for the rollout of an SRD. We only received this information yesterday. Also on that table, we note that the grant in aid, this one, what happened to it? Has it been subsumed into another one? And we would like clarity from, hopefully, at the instruction of your committee, to DOSD or Treasury or whoever is responsible for the allocation of that grant. We query the rationale behind the seeming omission of a vital provision.
Where is it at now, the amount table?
You see, on the table, chairperson, we see that amount only recorded as 20 million rand in the financial year 2004-05. Now, we know it's been active beyond that, and we're not quite sure whether this has been subsumed under something else, and it requires rather urgent clarity. This table...
Because my understanding of that grant is that it is intended almost as a way of substituting for the loss of income of
somebody who has to look after a person who is so debilitated that they are completely, on a 24-hour basis dependent on somebody. You have a situation where somebody is so severely disabled, whether a child who is a beneficiary of a care-dependent grant or an elderly person or a disabled person who's in receipt of those grants, but who in addition to that needs somebody else to care for them. So that amount. And I know in the disability rights movement, one of the arguments that we put forward was that the limited amount payable there, I think the nominal amount of over 100 grand a few years ago, I don't know where it is now, cannot quite represent the cost of having to put that person in an institution. And that to discourage that, the amount should be sufficient for the caregiver to be able to live on. But I don't know where those debates have ended, because I haven't been, maybe those are some of the things we need to resuscitate at some point. But sorry for interrupting you, but to bring that perspective.
Not at all, Chairperson. It is a question we wish to raise, and we will try and pursue answers for it. And as soon as we have some insight, we will let you know. But we would also hope that the influence of this committee to establish what has happened there would also be pursued simultaneously to provide clarity on this important question. Moving on, Chairperson, towards the end of our submissions, another observation we picked up in vote 16 is that the work of the Department of Social Development, the Office for Serious Economic Offences, and the National Treasury did significant work in promoting good governance and administration put in place by SASSA. That is to be commended. People who do not qualify for grants and do so for selfish interests should be criminally liable and punished for it. There is no doubt about that. But we're concerned about something that we've picked up. We commend the action, but whilst they've recovered 16.6 million from unentitled beneficiaries and the acknowledgement of debt of 77.7 million, there was a line that disturbed us. On page 331 of the vote, we note with concern that 123,610 beneficiaries have been cancelled due to non-collection or direct requests from beneficiaries. Now, when that direct request from a beneficiary is listed, we say, hooray, if that person found a job and is no longer requiring support from the state, that's a very positive development. But people who have cancelled, we need clarity as to whether the cancellation itself implicitly suggests, because it's categorized under the section combating fraud, that the person is therefore fraudulent. That doesn't make sense to us, because the people who come to the regional office of the Black Sash are those who seek help because of a range of reasons. It could be bureaucratic bungling, not understanding the process, lack of adequate documentation, and we're just concerned that there seems to be this one-liner of people who had their the cancellation being done in a manner that doesn't quite clarify the criteria for cancellation, and we want this to be clarified. During the period 2003-07, for example, we served 58,544 contacts within our casework strategy. Of them, 61% were assisted on particularly government grants. So more than 60% sought help around social grant issues. Now, those people we wish and hope is not categorized or on the list of beneficiaries who will be cancelled. We want to know the basis whereby the non-collection is associated with fraud.
Didn't the cancellation specify the ground of the beneficiary, even if they opt voluntarily to cancel? Does it simply say voluntarily cancelled? Because I would imagine if you feel that you no longer need
meet the ministers to Parliament, then it's only noble and good citizenship that you actually voluntarily, you know, offload yourself from the system. Or if you unknowingly receive the grant when you shouldn't have received it, it's not necessarily fraud, because fraud must have an element of criminal intent. Or it may well be that the person no longer meets the other criteria other than the means test. If disability hasn't been resolved, etc. But yeah, okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. The question again is, clarity needs to be given, and perhaps that needs to be described in the bus. My colleague, Leonie Caroline, and I'm not sure if this is protocol, perhaps at the end of the session, if we've got a minute or two, may clarify some of the burning questions you're answering, because she manages those issues on a day-to-day basis. The almost 36,000 clients we have served certainly has not been associated with issues of fraudulence, and let's hold it there for a moment. We commend the belated attempts of government to integrate and coordinate its approach to dealing with poverty, but we need a more comprehensive battle plan if we want to win this war, using State of the Nation speech. How can the proposed new national war room against poverty lead such an offensive without adequate resources? And over and above that, organizations like the Black Sash, the Children Institute Access, to our knowledge, have not been approached about participating in this national war room. And we hope it's not just a government initiative. We hope that the inclusion of NGOs and civil society organizations would be seriously considered. So the table demonstrates, for example, Chairperson, that in our info system, you could see that the nature of queries around child support grants for 2007 was around 10% of our caseload, as an average of the 7 regional offices, representing 642. Remember, these are people making queries. It is not a statistically significant piece of information. It is our stats of people who came to our offices. But it's certainly significant in terms of numbers. And you would see that over a 5-year period, this was 14% of our caseload, queries around child support grants. Then also, one very interesting thing, which cross-cuts social and consumer protection, is that in offices such as Grahamstown and Pietermaritzburg in particular, we are noticing a rising backlog on a different kind of grant. And that grant is unclaimed benefits from private pension funds. Now, this is very interesting because we have been consulting through NEDLAC and beginning to talk to some organizations in the business sector who are very concerned about this rising backlog in unclaimed benefits. At a conference in Magaliesburg on retirement reform, we did a submission to demonstrate the extent of the chronic nature of unclaimed benefits from private pension funds, and shows the lead, for example, that SASSA, a government agency, has taken up in resolving cases compared to the private sector. I mention this because those people who are due for the beneficiaries or the claimant, the person in whom the policy is registered, we are of the view that, particularly in the rural areas, these are people who pay for apartheid twice, and I don't say that lightly. Because of previous legislation, they were forced to work in Gauteng, in the mines, and they've given 40 to 50 years of their lives, they've come back, and they now want to retire. Many of the big businesses refuse to exercise sufficient diligence in trying to find these people. There are billions waiting in coffers, and what happens, Chairperson, is that those people become dependent on social protection when they shouldn't, only if big business did their work. There's slow progress in that regard, and many businesses have begun to approach both government and organizations like ourselves in order to roll that out, but we're very cautious for a range of reasons and want to see this issue resolved. So, to conclude...
Can I just... sorry for keeping on provoking a lot of... one of the challenges that I've picked up in my own work in my own constituency is that marriage status,
and the whole question of you know, marital relations does play a havoc on access to, especially when it comes to survivor's benefits, where, for example, a rigid approach that says you must prove the marital relations with the deceased as a precondition to access, and invariably for the children too. You know, proving those things have sent people from pillar to post, such that people simply give up pursuing some of this money. So there are a lot of underlying social issues as well that at some point we may need to zoom into to say what really accounts for this high numbers of unclaimed benefits. What are the drivers, and what kind of interventions can be made? Characterizing the problem properly.
Use your mic.
Sorry. I want to come in here because back home in the 50s, I'm invited almost regularly to the mine workers organization, where on investigations, the mines will always say they don't owe them money. They don't owe ex-miners money. Now you talk of billions. What mechanisms? One would be interested to know what mechanisms must be put in place so that there is a communication between the mines. Mines and big business, so that ex-miners can access what is due to them.
Maybe you want to say between the mines of employers and the retirement funds that are holding actually the money.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a mechanism needs to be found to correct them.
Okay. Sorry, I've got a point of order. Are we allowed to have general interrogation as we go along? Because we're sort of being polite to you.
Yeah. No, I am guilty. I've led this one and obviously broken all the rules. But he said that he...
Can we all play this now?
Well, he said that he was almost done. So, and in fact, I was going to allow us a body break, and then we could have a thorough engagement, unless there's something that's extremely burning, but it's almost concluded.
Yes, Chairperson, I want to raise the same conversation.
I was about to raise the same concern, Chairperson, to allow the presenter to finish.
Yes.
So that
I think
question time will get on.
The problem is that we don't have a whip, and that's why the Chairperson is not the please conclude, and then we'll have a short body break, and then we'll have a thorough engagement.
Pardon my age, I think you took advantage of
it. Yeah, I know. Yeah. All right. Please conclude.
Thank you, Chairperson, and apologies to the members if I was laid down the garden path of flooding protocol. It wasn't intended. So, Chairperson, I'm going to summarize our key recommendations and then raise a final issue, which has happened in the last week, which has critical importance on the work of this committee and, in our view, all of Parliament. So, we seek to engage on the details of the review of eligibility criteria and seek your support and advice on how best to take it forward, along with key campaign partners. We hope to engage with the honourable members of this committee, the NEC of the ANC, and all interested parties on a way forward that can address this national emergency. Along with our partners, we hope to engage with the members of this committee, DOSD, in order to ensure that supportive measures are made available, including the SRD award to adults and children, so as not to penalise those who continue to live in poverty. We would like to see clarity about the association of non-collection of grants with fraudulent behaviour. And we know that this is not in the, these demands or requests are not within the narrow ambit of this committee, but wish to have your input and support on the following issues. The issues around the role that exploitative business practices has on pushing people who should only be supported and defended by consumer protection now becoming the problem of the state, and the contribution towards the advocating for a reweighing of APEC's priorities, addressing unemployment and inequality more urgently. And of course, a participatory effective plan to support unemployment and marginalized people. In our submission, we allude, and this is the last point, to something called the poverty line. And since then, in the last week, there has been a flurry of activities, some of which may have been witnessed by honorable members themselves. Last week, I think it was Thursday or Friday, at the International Conference for Social Development, there was a round table to discuss the poverty line. The Black Sash, the SATU, and other civil society organizations were invited by DOSD to participate in this meeting. When we arrived there, we were told we could not enter. We were summarily kicked out, to the great embarrassment of the Department of Social Development, who apologized profusely, but it was an instruction of the National Treasury. Since the Black Sash also serves in the community constituency of Nedlac, we were aware that the meeting called by the Nedlac Exco, which is an extraordinary move to discuss the poverty line as requested by the Ministry of Finance and Stats SA, the Statistician General, Pali Laotla, to a meeting at Nedlac to take the process forward. We attended along with other representatives from the community and the Labour constituency. What then happened, honourable members, concerned us greatly. We asked for the status of the meeting, because as you know, there's a protocol in Nedlac. If as a community we raise issues in Nedlac and come to agreement on that, and then come to Parliament and raise the same issue, we are out of order. So we wanted to honour the protocol of Nedlac, of not raising issues in an out of order manner. And so when asking about the status, we were given a rather vague answer by Stats SA, and previously they reported to a poverty task team that didn't sign off on the inputs on the poverty line. And so when we did not get a clear answer, and at the intervention of Herbert Mkhize, who said there cannot be an informal briefing in Nedlac, it's either formal or not, we heard the status and then left the chamber so as not to participate in those meetings. Business was stating that they were aware of the concern, but government and business listened to this presentation. Now, one of our key concerns is the manner, the procedure, and the content. We have substantive and procedural concerns about how this very important issue was raised. And early this morning, I got a summary of our position on the poverty line. And we are of the view that deciding to institute a poverty line, just a line, and if we can go back to this graph, the most brutal way of doing this is just to draw a line along an income category to say, this is not quite the appropriate graph. It should be along income streams. These people qualify and others don't. We find very problematic. So if it's done purely on an income line basis, it's going to have serious consequences, particularly to the South African context. Determining how and where that line should be drawn is an issue of significant national interest and importance, and will have far-reaching consequences for all who live in our country. We believe that a broad, inclusive, and transparent consultation must be held, taking the diverse views held by all South Africans, if we are to realize the vision laid out in the Constitution of South Africa with all people living in dignity. Along with the community constituency partners at Nedlac, we call on the Minister of Finance to halt the imminent announcement of a national poverty line for South Africa and allow for proper comprehensive consultation. So, Chairperson, let me leave those concerns there, and just in ask for your indulgence if there are any questions that may be hanging, and if it's the wish of the committee that myself and Ms. Caroline try and answer you as best as possible. And she has made a list of the key questions that we need to follow up with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Aldopoulos from Black Sash. I think, if anything, this has been just as informative as it has been educative. So we're going to have a short break, body break. I'm not sure if the tea is still warm or what. Are we going to get some fresh tea at another point?
At 11.
All right. Let's have a body break, and then we will allow your colleague to add in any point. Perhaps we'll allow for issues to be raised so that when she comes in, she can respond to the new issues that arise as well. All right, 5 minutes break and we'll resume.
We still have our own
research,
or are we now back to a situation where our researcher gets called and sent elsewhere and so on?
Growing our
We will need to prepare for the department starts the
this morning, but I got delayed with that now.
Arising out of the input from several programs and from your own research, you should be able to pick up issues around which we are not going to get the department. So the budget process is completed.
Okay.
When we come back, we'll be back with the budget. During the budget.
So you want me to prepare
some kind of analysis that also has set of questions.
Analysis of the budget.
Yeah.
Okay.
And raising any questions that you think the department may need to respond on behalf of the committee.
Okay.
That we can in fact forward so that be they arising from the presentation or arising from your own and we need to look at previous documents that were forwarded to the so that we can see whether there has been some problem on the issue.
I don't know. Yeah. Let's see if we can get my secretary to
give it. Give it to me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's carry on.
Yeah. Okay, shall we start so?
Just find me the number,
please. Hot coffee is going to come at 11. So. Huh? Oh, has it arrived? Oh, all right. Let's have the fresh tea then. Let's have a few more minutes for people to pour their
first one.
And then let's start. Oh, here's the pour. Before you have the number, I am going to yeah, and then we send my dear husband.
Inga.
Just arrived.
Yes, Inga. Yes, Inga.
It's not available.
No. Your sister is in there. As long as you protect Kandavari Mary.
Yes, I'm just
yes.
Here, madam, your presence will always be appreciated. Okay, we're going to round off the Black Sash input, but before I ask the other presenter from Black Sash, I'd rather first open it up and get a bit of dialogue happening so that presenter could also respond to other issues that people have to raise. It's your turn now. Hoshi is first, and then Mawiba will follow her, and then we'll see. All right.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question, Chairperson, to the presenter. I just want to find out why Black Sash is not user-friendly to the poor people who are staying in the rural areas. They are staying only in cities. My second question, Chairperson, I just want to find out from the presenter. I did not hear him clearly addressing the procedures of our budgeting system.
Are you aware that
the budget is controlled by the estimate strategic plan, and thereafter the budget and the business plan? And in your presentation also, I did not hear you talking about the challenges caused by Department of Justice with regard to maintenance and court orders, and also challenges caused by Department of Health with regard to issuing of illegal immunization cards and the shortage of social worker and the surgical doctors which perform the function of accessing people who are supposed to be a permanent disability and temporary disability. And also, I did not hear you addressing challenges caused by the Department of Traffic with regard to cars which use insurances for the driver only, meanwhile they are transporting more than 100 people. After the accident is going to impact on the very same Department of Social Development. And also, I did not hear you addressing challenges caused by Home Affairs for issuing illegal birth certificates, illegal IDs, and illegal passport. And also,
Ma, are you wanting to raise the point of order?
Yes, please, Chair. Could I make a point of order?
Mm.
I think she's got it wrong. I don't think that Lexa should be involved in all that. That's social development as such. I think Blacksash are just, you know, involved in children as such, per se. I don't think Blacksash must be expected to go through all these different portfolios.
Well, I'm sure they're grown up. They can speak for themselves.
Yes, I'm not out of politics. I'm not out of politics.
Let me say, No, let me indicate that.
Let me carry on with my question, Chairperson.
Yeah, let me just make the one point that remember there is this other issue of comprehensive social security, which talks to the broader issue of comprehensive social security. So Hoshi, in a sense, is trying to give a holistic picture, in a way, to the issue.
Thank you, Chairperson. And also, Chairperson, is BlackSearch aware that in terms of budgeting procedure, you cannot budget for contingency, which means issues which just emerge while the budget have already allocated, you cannot address them unless you are going to address them at the next financial year. Thank you, Chairperson.
All right, Ms. Liba, it's your turn.
Thank you, Chairperson. It seems to me that Blackstash should also assist the MPs on getting home affairs into order, because I feel that an awful lot of problems are caused by home affairs. The business of pensions not being paid out, that all these millions of rand that are left there, this surely could be addressed by these people who know that they. There are pensioners out there who are not getting pensions, that they should be able to go to home affairs and find out where these people are. So I feel that the Blacksash would also do well in assisting us in bringing home affairs into order. And also I feel that Blacksash could also assist us, I have spoken already to Elroy, regarding the fines that are paid over by big business as to where the fines are going. So I think we could do with all the support we can get in addressing that as well. Thank you.
All right. Sorry. Who else? Anybody else who wants to ask any questions?
No.
But in the absence of none, I can add Chairperson.
Yeah.
Please proceed, question. Thank you, Chairperson. Also, I just want to find out from the FlexEdge whether in their own assessment have they checked the question of capacity in filling the scarce skills with regard to the intake, because some of the funded posts which were not filled is because of scarce skills. For example, you find there is a a post where they need somebody who specializes in physical science and mathematics. All the intake, none of them have attended those courses in their matric level. Thank you, Chief.
Lana, you want to say something?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. I know that the Black Sash concerns around social relief of distress, and just as information, I am aware that the department or MINMEC has already issued directives in terms of that the spending on social relief of distress must be fast-tracked in the respective provinces. The Select Committee on Finance, when they had their fourth quarterly budget hearings, when they called the MECs, were also focusing on this issue. And knowingly that whilst the regulations is not finalized and that provinces apply social relief of distress in different manners. You know, one province will give uniforms and another province will give food parcels. There are currently no, universal guidelines that sort of like enforces this. But that a legislative framework has been developed. But the only thing is it's not on the legislative program for 2008. So it's not, it was not one of those priorities that could have been agreed to in these time frames. But that a social relief of distress bill would be introduced probably very soon after the election with the notion that this function be signed over to the provinces. And then there will be, you know, processes of public consultation and comments and all of that that will follow the full process. Just in terms of future, you know, approach on that. Thanks.
All I can mention there is that when the department proposed to scrap this pending them establishing a new framework, we simply refused as the committee. We said you couldn't do that. You have to come with something else on the table first before we could agree in the new Social Assistance Act when we passed it in 2004 for it to exclude relief of distress. So we did acknowledge the reality that there were problems with this type of grant, and that a proper legal framework would have to be developed to properly structure the program. But we said until that is done, in the meantime, inefficient as the existing arrangement may be, it simply must be there. And then just also, I would want you people to maybe elaborate more on this poverty measure issue. What ideally should a poverty line be measuring? What kind of models out there can be explored in terms of measuring poverty? Clearly, income poverty alone is not going to solve our problems, because if you look at the value of, for example, the housing subsidy scheme and its contribution to the assets of the poor, it's something that is too significant not to be taken into account. And the question who has access and who doesn't in relation to that becomes very critical to the question of poverty and taking people out of poverty and other social transfers which are not in cash necessarily. But all right, that is the full suite of questions. Please proceed, and your colleague can also use the opportunity to give the additional input that she wanted to make.
Honourable members, thank you very much for detailed questions. I'm going to try and do justice to all 17 of them. I hope the nature of the questions is not because of the of critical shortcomings, but I get the sense that it's a desire to participate and underscore the importance of the issues that all of us share. Let me try and propose to do it this way, Chair. I'd like to list the questions you raised while I was making the presentation and suggest that I try and answer that, or my colleague Leone answer some of them. So just to recap, there were reminders, questions and statements. You raised the issue about getting to grips or understanding better why young people when they're unemployed are not absorbed in the labor market. We can provide feedback on that at a future date. With regard to the issue of quantitative versus qualitative means of measuring impact of grants on the quality of health and well-being of children, I would strongly suggest that a future engagement, particularly with Children's Institute and similar organizations, be taken up with this committee at the time most convenient to all of us and as soon as possible. You also referred to the...
In fact, I would just request that them, if they could indulge us, they have a booklet, a book actually, that they published. They didn't offer to present to us because their issues relate to provincial spending. But I said to them that, look, well, neither here nor there, if they can spare a few minutes of their time and just give us a summary, that would be appreciated. So they'll do that at the end.
Another issue, Chair, in respect of the child support grant, that families receiving social grants, the question was, it doesn't go to them, it goes to, because of this big gaping hole in the economically active population, we need to unpack how it affects their quality of life. Around the grant in aid, is the amount sufficient for caregivers to live on, something you've done personal research about? We would like to revert, try and get to the bottom of it and report it to the committee, but at the same time ask that you use your influence to ask the Department of Social Development to provide more insights into this issue. So it will be a two-pronged approach. The fifth thing is on the issues of cancellation and clarity. I think Ms. Caroline can provide some valuable information about the dynamics underpinning when that cancellations kick in and why. It's linked to a range of very interesting, important, and complex factors, which she can enumerate better than I can. Then in terms of the issue of survival benefits as a precondition, one of the challenges that remains, I'm not sure she wrote this very fast, but we can get back to that question. The issue of proof and eligibility.
Yeah, it's the issue of eligibility, really.
Thank you for the clarity. The high number of unclaimed benefits. We would actually, at a future date, like to do the presentation that we did to Magaliesburg on that and inform the committee about initiatives that had happened in the last 2 months, both by business, labor, and community, to begin to addressing these issues. Then to the question, and I can try and answer this more directly, on rural areas, where the Black Sash is situated. Honorable Member Hoshi, that issue is very close to us too. Before my time, I've just started working with Black Sash 5 months ago. Ms. Caroline could enumerate the many other offices we had also in the rural areas previously. I think there was a funding crisis around 2005-06. The Black Sash also is leading in helping to capacitate old advice offices, in some of which are located in very rural areas, through a NADCAO structure, which is an organization supporting the capacitation and advice offices. So in the medium to long term, there would be support and hopefully a revival of those old advice offices. I think it's important to point out the fact that the capacity of some advice offices of specific issues we experience all the time. Typical example is, and Caroline can elaborate on that too, by example, Grahamstown has many advice offices coming from Fort Beaufort, Adelaide, the Toffinvaba area, Mount Fletcher, on these unclaimed benefits which they don't know what to do about. So through a long process, it goes to an advice officer that doesn't have the capacity, and then it comes to Grahamstown, and we take it up. And our casework shows that there have been very, very long delays through the structures that should deal with it. I think it was I'm not sure if it's the registrar of pensions or the adjudicator that has a waiting list of about a year of these cases. It's a huge national problem. Then, second question by Honourable Member Hoshi, the procedures regarding the budget system, the various aspects in the rollout of the budget plan. Chair, if you may indulge me, in many ways the black sash is sticking out its neck in doing the submission. Because we form part of the People's Budget Campaign, we form part of the Financial Sector Campaign Coalition, and some of them have chosen not to engage on the budget in respect of Parliament, because Section 77 of the Constitution calls for the implementation of what is called a Money Laws Amendment Bill. Now, way back in the late 90s, when Chairperson Hogan was the Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Finance, a draft was submitted by the National Treasury on a Money Laws Amendment Bill, because the Constitution said that an Act of Parliament should enable Parliament to amend their budget. Now, the long-standing position by both COSATU, the SACC, and Sankoko, maybe one of the reasons why Sankoko chose not to present today, is because they don't want to engage the budget. We've chosen to do that because of the urgency of the matter, and we may get flak for them from that issue, but it was a strategic endorsed decision to engage on these budget issues. But we share the concern that Parliament itself cannot really amend the budget in ways that are precedent setting in other parts of the world, and we would like to engage you on this issue. So within that framework, Honourable Member Hoshi, there may be a process, but we don't believe it's consultative enough. We don't believe that Tips for Trevor actually makes any changes to the current budget inputs, because it is a few weeks before Parliament, and therefore the People's Budget Campaign recommendation is not for the 2008-09 year, it's for the 2009-10 year, because it takes about 18 months to provide and finalize, to nail down what goes into the budget on budget day. So it's something very close to our heart that the budget process, from a civil society perspective, is not sufficiently transparent. With regards to the Department of Justice, I think the experience of one of our regional officers could provide a plethora of examples of the administrative challenges around court orders, the shortage of skilled staff, which you've mentioned, which is so real and painful to many of the clients we serve, the classifications of various categories of people who qualify, the issue around the Department of Transport, where the benefits are claimed in a questionable or sometimes illegal manner, issues around COIDA and the Road Accident Fund. Those are important issues, but those are within those votes. And so, Honourable Member Semple is correct in that we're addressing vote 16. Mm-hmm. However, I need to say to members that the work of the Black Sash is beyond just dealing with issues of children. The organization, if you go to our website, deals with far broader group of people. These would be vulnerable, marginalized people living in living standard measures 1 to 5, even people outside of that who have been blacklisted because we've launched the Paralegal Guide on Debt and Credit recently. Our work around consumer protection. But I think I need to underscore this. It's interrelationship to, if you fall out of consumer protection, which way are you going to go? Are you going to become dependent on the state again? Affect the work of your committee. I agree with the concerns expressed around the efficacy of Home Affairs. In the many reports that come from our regional directors on a quarterly basis, many of the bungles is linked to Home Affairs. But I was hoping that Ms. Leonie Caroline could speak and give examples of that. Around the issues of contingency, yes, we cannot budget around that, we agree. Typically in budgets over the MTF period, we've seen amounts of 4 to 5 billion rand being set aside for contingency reserves. So some of it for disaster mitigation or unforeseen circumstances from their planning linked to inflation or and so on. On that point, Ms. Honourable Member Weber has raised also the issue of Home Affairs competency or incompetency. But when fees are recovered, and this is the other question, as demonstrated in the work done by the Competition Commission, one of the recommendations we made is that when fees are recovered from big business for as fines, one of the things we don't want is for the Treasury or the National Revenue Fund, whatever controls them, to have discretionary powers on how that money should be used. If money is recovered for the state, recovered in a conservative sense, in that it remains in the coffers or is and comes back to the state because of finding people guilty of corruption, that money should either remain in the line item or be used around the issue it was recovered from. And so I would agree very strongly that issues around school nutrition, issues around support for capacitation of teachers or social workers, or the money in the line item it was recovered from is used and ring-fenced, and that is not used to build a soccer stadium or be used too discretionarily for purposes other from whence it was recovered. Then on the issue that Ms. Lana from the Department of Social Development has provided us, that conversation that you had and the input from the chair was very useful and educative for us, and we are very heartened that the committee has put its foot down in that SRD allocation should not be excluded from the Social Assistance Act way back in 2004, and we commend you back for that, and that a proper legal framework needs to happen. And we note the discretion by which provinces choose to apply who qualifies and don't. And we certainly feel that a minimum standard should be called for. It reminds one of the similar process around when people owe municipalities money and do expanded public works programs. One of the biggest complaints from one of the affiliates of the Sarkic Samu was that there's no norms and standards. And so if people owe money on the electricity and choose to contribute through sweat equity, some municipalities, for example, say you can paint the school for 2 weeks, and then that will only be the interest that you accrued on your electricity account. Now, on what level is that discretion given to a municipal official or a government official to apply, exclude, include people that should have access to this very, very important grant whilst they wait for a more medium to long-term decision from the state? And so I hope I've answered the questions as best I can, and the outstanding questions may be answered by Ms. Caroline.
Thank you very much. Ms. Caroline, do you want to come in? I just want to indicate that whilst one appreciates the stance taken by the sister organizations, we do appreciate your coming forward and interacting, because that in a sense enriches our own process here and gives it more meaning. But to also say that it may well be that it's a fait accompli that the budget is already passed by the time we engage with it. But I think that one important useful purpose that this kind of exercise achieves is to critique the already passed budget such that in future when the department bids, they have in mind, or at the back of their mind, the concerns that had been raised by the committee previously, and to know that those concerns will not go away until in future bids they do something about it. Because let's be frank, it's not as if Treasury sits there and just make unilateral decisions. Departments have to bid for some of these things, and sometimes these things are simply not bidded for, and so on. So I think that's another context to it that needs to be taken on board. All right. Your colleague, Ms. Caroline.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Perhaps I should start by saying that we work in a wide range of areas, and Elroy has politely put in a black sash statistic in the pack. So perhaps if I can just take you through some of the areas that you work in. I won't go in depth, I will just clarify some of it. If we work in the area of consumer protection, and that would be the consumer contracts, as well as the area of debt. And the main areas there, obviously, the new National Credit Act has been passed, and the assistance, how it plays itself out, the debt relief, the debt counseling services that is available to the poor and the rural communities. The child support grant, I think the area of grants, I suppose the child support would be a combination of the child support as we know it, the child support grant, it will also be our foster care grant, and it will also be the maintenance, private maintenance as we call it. The disability grant, the total there will be what you find the disability grant in the social assistance tax, but it will also be the disability as we know it in compensation, the COIDA, and to a limited extent in terms of the road accident fund. So that is our broad category for the grant disability. Grant retirement will help us to understand the old age pension, the state old age pension, but it also helps us what we call the public-private pension fund. The grant unemployment is, as we know it, the unemployment, the UIF. The grants other could be any other grant that we don't know that may come up, but it's probably your disaster or your social relief of the state that could see. We work with labor and the people that most come as the vulnerable workers, and most of them are unorganized or non-unionized members. Other is our social grants, problems, housing, evictions, water, fees, that is the other. The citizenship, particularly is the ID documents, the South African ID documents, but the high number here is because of the work that we do with the refugee and asylum seekers. So we do work in that particular area. So I do hope that it gives a broad understanding of the area of the black sash that you work in. The offices, you correct, is basically in major cities in the four provinces. We have only one office in Knysna, which could be defined as in a rural community, but the Western Cape government says Knysna is urban. So that's the only one that's not in the metros. The Arrow has mentioned that
you work... Isn't Knysna rich?
Elroy did mention that we work with, I'm particularly talking about the concern of where the black sash works and what the black sash are doing. We do have the paralegal advice offices that we do provide capacity training on a range of issues. It could be community leaders, it could be union members, it could be advice office workers, and also it can be just only community members that we would then go out and do what we call rights education or workshops on the areas that we feel comfortable with. So comprehensive social security, and I think that is a major challenge to all of us, to start thinking overarching, because we've all been working in our little silos. And so the questions that you raised obviously is a challenge also to the black sash. Why did we not make a presentation on YAL, for instance? But for the black sash, with limited resources, limited staffing capacity, we find that we, in civil society, we then join forces with other civil society organizations. So we are part of the Right to YAL campaign, as well as the Right to Food campaign. And then we then strengthen one another in terms of the expertise that the doctors can bring to the Right to YAL, the expertise that we can bring in terms of our understanding of social security and how income could assist with nutrition and basic food, etc. The issue of home affairs, it is a very, very big concern. And as I've alerted to you, that we work on two levels, the one with the refugees, as well as the South African access to documentation. We've just heard in the KwaZulu-Natal area that the lawyers, almost on a daily basis, we still have to verify it, but we've heard it from a very reliable source, from somebody that's in the legal department in the Department of Home Affairs,
They told us that, in her view, almost on a daily basis, they are appearing in the High Court, either in Durban or in Maritzburg, because of an ID document. People don't have an ID document, and they therefore cannot access the social grants. And somewhere along the line, we need to look at, is it more cost effective to continue pay high litigation costs, or to reassign that particular money for staffing and capacity within the organization, so that it can deliver. I've also mentioned the issue of skills, scarce skills. Obviously with us, it would be particularly the area that we are comfortable with. And the area that we particularly work in is the areas that I just spoke to about now. With regards to the Department of Traffic, obviously our concern, when we would make an input on that, it would be the cost that it costs today to go and collect your child support grant. In certain areas, I'm from the Western Cape, so most of the statistics or figures will come like that, is that in certain areas they pay 30 rand for a taxi to go to a pay point, whereas the minister last year said it should be in walking distance 5 kilometers. So we still have people paying 30 rand in the rural areas, the Western Cape rural, which is not deep rural as in the other provinces, 30 rand to go collect the grant. And last year when we spoke to the Department of Social Development Provincial, we wanted to know why is there so a low uptake in certain areas of the child support grant. And he mentioned that it could be that it's just not worth the bother. Because if you go for one child, you have to pay 60 rand just for taxi fee to go collect it. What are you going home with? So for some people, maybe, but they haven't done the research. That's what they told me. But our input would then be there in terms of accessibility for transport and subsidies that the various municipalities could provide for people to go collect their disability grants or whatever grants it is. So that would be our area of interest. Our areas of road accident fund has been a bit slow these days because of the new law and the debate what the road accident fund should be, whether it's a social security system or whether it should be as it is now. But that, at the moment, that would be our input on the... With regards to scarce skills, obviously we would all like to see, as we mentioned about Asgisa, and we would love to see, we are parents also, that our children should grow into those kind of scarce skills. But with particular to the area that we work in, the problem with the social worker. And how are we going to address the issue of the foster care grant? How are we going to address the issue of social relief of distress? Because in the Western Cape, the social relief of distress must go through a social worker report. If we don't have social workers to do the report, we won't be able to access the social relief of distress. Foster care, and I do know that there is a difference of opinion in terms of should you go for child support or should you go for foster care, but the law makes allowance of foster care. If we do not have social workers, what is reasonable for a child to go through the process of foster care? Is it 3 years? Is it 4 years? Is it 5 years? So I think we would definitely would like to engage with the department just to hear from them what is reasonable. And we certainly do not want to go proceed on each and every case by case through the courts. And I think we already seen cases coming forward and people putting pressure on us, and we putting pressure should we go to the lawyers to shorten this waiting period or what we should be doing. But certainly the department must come clean to say what is reasonable. Is it 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, or 5 years? We don't know, but there is unhappiness around the foster care and the shortage there. The other problem maybe with your social relief of distress, and I think when we interrogate with the bill, obviously will be a concern in terms of the service providers, because we also encounter that the departments don't pay on payday to the shops, and now you have a voucher, you go to ShopRite or wherever, they don't want to take your voucher anymore. So those kind of systems also will have to be addressed, because you may have your social workers, but if the department don't pay the shop, and especially if you're in the deep rural area, how is it going to impact on you? How many times must you go from social worker to shop to SASSA? Because those are the three role players just with social relief of distress. I hope I've touched on most of it. Just add to what Calder already said.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think we're running out of time, so we're going to leave it there so that we can proceed to UNICEF, who are also having time pressures. Thank you very much, Black Sesh. You always add value to our work, really. And I think that our research unit will just collate the issues that you have raised, so that next week when we engage with the department and SASA, we can raise them in a pointed way. All right. We are going to proceed with UNICEF, and then after that have a brief presentation from Paula, from the Child Institute, Children's Institute. All right.
Good morning.
Welcome, Ms. Joyce September from UNICEF. You can introduce your team, etc.
Good morning, ma'am, Chair and honourable members. I'm not going to take you too long. I will not do a PowerPoint presentation, but an oral submission. I'd like to start by...
I'll open the curtains and enjoy the fresh light that UNICEF is bringing to us. All right. Don't worry, sit down, somebody will help. Is it too bright? Is it covered? All right, please proceed.
Also, to expedite matters, I will read our submission. Just a short introduction to emphasize that UNICEF remains impressed with the vision and the aim of the Department of Social Development, and which it finds admirable. However, it's also evident that although major challenges remain, the department has made considerable advances towards achieving its objectives. This is reflected in the budgetary allocations of both 16 as tabled by the Minister of Finance in February 2008. This vote, of course, is divided into five programs, of which the main aim is to work towards the delivery of integrated social developmental services. UNICEF wished to make respectfully the following comments on these programs. We've not included the program one, which pertains to the administration, but we will make comments on program two, three, four, and five. Firstly, then, comments on program two, pertaining to comprehensive social security, which was found on page 313. In this general program, the government or social development, most significant contribution towards comprehensive social security is outlined. The gap within comprehensive social security, however, is still startling. For example, neither here nor in other parts of the chapter, the extension of the child support grant to 14 years old is mentioned. There is also no indication of how the plight of poor children between 15 and 18 will be addressed. This remains a major concern for UNICEF. It is also not clear that, and I quote, improving access of household beneficiaries of social assistance to economic opportunities can be achieved by what is called leveraging social assistance grants, as pertained in page 313. This is particularly so because, one, the skill and asset base of grant beneficiaries is particularly low. Two, the size of the grant, especially child support grant, is limited. Three, the grant remains means tested and leaves out significant numbers of the poor, especially poor children at this point. Four, there's no systematic mechanism that links beneficiaries to other exiting poverty alleviation programs, and this was alluded to before. And then number five, Beneficiaries are not naturally linked to social support services nor any other exit strategies. This remains a concern. For example, are the beneficiaries who are on the child support grant prioritized for the EPWP program or any other employment strategies that's reserved for these families? These are the issues that Black Sash this morning have raised. It is recommended that improved access to economic opportunities be achieved through active labor market policies targeting especially youth, emphasizing public-private partnerships on the job training and remedial interventions such as second chance education for school dropouts. It is advisable to associate job-specific training to life skills, training such as basic literacy, numeracy, attitudes on the work, on the job, job search skills, among others, especially for youth. Again, something that has been mentioned before. Two words about the expenditure trends in Program 2. While earmarked allocations to monitoring and evaluation activities are very welcome, given that monitoring and evaluation functions are critical to boost effective planning and execution capacity, it is not clear to which specific monitoring and evaluation activities additional allocation of 11 million, 6 million, and 9 million over the NTEF will be allocated. Secondly, is the management of information system for social welfare services mentioned on page 318 the same as or will be included by the comprehensive monitoring and evaluation system to improve service delivery mentioned on the beginning of page 315 and the monitoring and evaluation activities mentioned in 327? The National Integrated Social Information System is also mentioned in page 318. Which is an alternative departmental initiative or interdepartmental initiative. Will this serve a different purpose than yet another comprehensive monitoring and evaluation system, which is mentioned on page 315? Moreover, although improving the efficiency and effectiveness of social assistance by conducting an impact evaluation study of the child support grant is key to the objective of Program 2, it is not clear whether the budget for this study will also come from the budget on item 2 in Table 16.7 under Program 5, and we will allude to it, or will it be financed under budget item 1 in Table 16.4 under Program 2. It is recommended that the mapping between specific monitoring and evaluation activities, the objectives and budget allocations be clarified. You'll find in budget there's about 3 or 5 different budget allocations towards simplifying the monitoring and evaluation system of the department, but currently those items seem not to link to each other, to not synergize, so one do not know whether they are going to be one comprehensive information system or program evaluation system, or if it's, as it currently is, dispersed throughout the different programs, and that these evaluation systems don't talk to each other. This is problematic. There seems to be quite a disproportion between the breadth of M&E activities mentioned throughout the chapter and the paucity of M&E budget allocation under Program 5. This disproportion is even more evident if one considers that SASSA alone received 70 million for management information activities only in 2007. It is important that the increase in SASSA administration budget, seen on page 319, be assessed against achievements of concrete operational targets. For example, it is not clear to what extent the improved grant administration process, as in ICAP, and improved access to services by rural communities has contributed to a reduction of the average gap and to an increase of take-up among children at birth or just a few days after birth. Important gaps still exist, as a recent study conducted by CASE has alluded to. We still find that the uptake of children between 0 and 3 is a major concern. Because of these gaps, the CSG is not yet leveraging all its developmental potential in this critical age group, when nutritional conditions are especially rapidly deteriorating between 3 and 9 months old, especially, of course, in the most poorest communities. Something more on program two, on page 322 of the budget vote. A considerable amount of resources has been allocated to SASSA's MIS program, 55.7 million in 2006-07, 70 million in 2007-08, and an additional 20 million per year over the MTEF for the establishment and operation of the management information system. An obvious question is, what are the results achieved in 2006-08, which justify another 20 million per year over the next 3 years? What was the value added with the monies already received? We recommend clarifying the link, if any, between this management information system effort and the overdue reform of the SOCPEN. A reform of SASSA information management should indeed be including a reform of SOCPEN, one we would think, but results are not yet evident in this direction. Then on program three, the following. Policy development review and implementation support for social welfare services. In line with government's developmental approach, the legislation and policy reform within Department of Social Development reflects an emphasis on prevention and early intervention and, of course, carefully crafted essential tertiary level intervention. That's the idea. The legislation passed during 2007, especially the New Children's Act, has significant implications for reform and upscaling of social welfare services. The budget specifies the increase of scholarships and staffing, but moreover, the institutional capacity and infrastructural implications of the Children's Act is gigantic, as indicated in the Children's Bill and the costing report. What is necessary is a detailed implementation plan which includes specific capacity development strategies and its associated costs. These are not evident in the budget bill. In regard to the full spectrum of Program 3, the cost associated with training and capacity development of staff is not explicit in the budget. If the National Department is assuming the role of oversight, leadership and guidance to the provinces, then there will have to be significant investment in the capacity development and support for this level first, i.e. the National Department, especially because the tools, instruments and materials necessary are non-existent at this point of time. This is a capacity development and training. This is a specialized activity and the backbone of transformation of social welfare services. It therefore demands a comprehensive strategy and a dedicated budget. More energy, effort and focus must be given to the diversifying of social development workforce. It is no longer and it's generally expected and accepted that social workers can no longer be the only service providers of the sector. Furthermore, this program, program three, is a program that must articulate the desired synergy with a comprehensive social security system. Program 2 as well as Program 4. Program 4 speaks to the imperatives of designing sustainable livelihoods, and I'm not going to go through examples because BlackSash has already talked about this, especially for this constituency that the Department of Social Welfare Department serves. Program 4, Community Development. Besides the fact that this program is intended to bring services closer to where it is needed, it does not appear to be mainstreamed into the core services as provided under Program 3, as intended by the new DSD service model. This is where the prevention and early intervention elements of service delivery should be spearheaded from. This program also gives expression to the government's commitment to partner with civil society, NGOs, and other development agencies such as the NDA to strengthen the state's capacity to reduce poverty. However, the budget and the description of the means to achieve this under this program is not clear. The size and the scope of the services provided under this program for community development may be indicative of the fact that the shift towards developmental social welfare services is lagging behind. The new legislation and policy reform, regulations and further guidelines provide an important opportunity for review and betterment, especially for children and their families. And lastly, Program 5. Program 5 deals with strategy and governance and is reflected on page 322. A substantial budget increase is driven by the need to increase capacity and oversight functions in the department. This is a welcome development. It is critical to support the execution of activities at the provincial level. Nonetheless, given the importance of training, oversight, and supervision of activities to boost service delivery, it is striking that the budget allocated to entity oversight is just about double of what is allocated to population research. Moreover, it is probably Program 5 that bears most of the burden of ensuring that an integrated social development package is delivered to those in need. Which of the Program 5 activities, as articulated in the document, are considered most pivotal to achieve this result, i.e. an integrated social development package? Honourable members, it is evident through, again, this morning's presentation and our learnings throughout the past 10 years that unless we upscale and program for integrated social development activities, it doesn't happen by chance. The challenge for this government and its machinery remains to look at much more integrated development programs which draws together all the existing programs of government that speaks to the eradication of poverty, of which they, of course, are not a scarcity. It's a question of what kind of mechanisms should be in place to ensure that these machineries talk to each other. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that brief and succinct and to the point presentation. We're going to open briefly for interaction with this with presentation. I just want you to comment on the role of the population unit. I think you alluded partly to it being poorly funded. We have on a number of occasions called them here and asked them what exactly are you people doing? Because we're not hearing enough, you're not visible, your work is not visible enough, at least to us. We certainly know that SA is up there and the data is, you know, subject of a lot of public engagement. But the work of the department seems to go on, without necessarily being apparently seen, seeming to be significantly influenced by what comes out of the population unit. So maybe you can give us your own perspective on that. But the matter is open for discussion. Any comments, questions? Hoshi?
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by thanking UNICEF. It did a very good job, like Black Fed Chairperson, for assisting us to engage on this budget. My first question, Chairperson, just want to find out from the presenter, how do you view the question of the budget not in line with the strategic plan? And number two, the question of monitoring, especially the service provider. Number three, the question of internal audit. Number four, inspectorate on the ground where people are getting grants. Number five, the question of budget. When environment is used, you cannot exceed 8% to change your budget. How do you view that one? Coming to the question of community development, most NGO are not accountable to the community. You find the NGO which get funding from the government, the very same people, they are saying they are doing that on their behalf. There is no steering committee from that community. The very same NGO from Eben, it comes with its own NGO. Who is going to monitor whether the money they got really are they providing to the community on the ground? Thank you, Chairperson.
All right, thank you. Ms. Sample, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. Just on Chief Horsey's questions, I'm not sure. But I'm going to leave you on that, Chair, because it sounds like more like questions we should be asking the department on the budget, not UNICEF. I don't think they can answer questions about environment and stuff like that. But anyway, my question...
Be big enough to make that assessment.
Chair, on Program 3, I'd just like to ask UNICEF. Professor September talks about going beyond just training social workers. Is she alluding to sections such as psychologists and that sort of thing? What did she have in mind there?
All right, thank you. Any further questions? All right, over to you, Ms. Tanda.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. I think I especially opened the statement to say how UNICEF, whom work closely with the Department of Social Development, supports the department wholeheartedly. And we do believe that their strategic goals specifically outlined in the aims of this budget articulates government and the country's strategic plans, and that remains admirable. We also emphasize the fact that most of the issues that the department currently deals with are not, are of course, or could be associated with precisely the time in which our country is. And I don't think we South Africans always give government the credit for how difficult it is to develop systems. And so the question, the issues that we've raised in this response, you would see, relates to the building and the development of the institutional capacity that government needs to reach this kind of objective that it sets for itself. For example, the issue of developing information systems that capture the kind of information that you need to both plan but also to evaluate what you are doing. The monitoring and evaluation system in the department currently needs an overhaul because precisely as you said, we do not, for example, have in government a clear set of indicators for the well-being of children, for example. How would we know how well we're doing if we don't have indicators? And that indicators must be there so that we can know how we are doing. But indicators in of itself is nothing unless you have information systems and evaluation programs that is capable and effective to collect the kind of data to make that decision whether you are doing well or not doing well. So therefore, the input and comment of UNICEF that is an element that the Department of Social Development really, really needs to foreground in developing the institutional capacity to deliver. The second issue is the issue around community development. We do feel that this is a program that have always lingered in the background of social development, yet it has the potential to transform the service delivery mechanisms where it matters most, closest to the people. That relates to your very, very important input around the support for NGOs. What kind of support systems are there in place for NGOs that the government partners with? And of course, there are huge funding issues in terms of the policy that the government has in terms of funding NGOs. But besides the funding issues, the capacity though that those NGOs need to be able to deliver and to be effective partners to reach the overall aims and objectives. So that remains a concern. The whole relationship between the department and its key partners, which is the community-based organizations and NGO society. That links very directly to if the goal is to bring social welfare services closer to the people. Of course, social work education is expensive. There's a notion that social work qualification is the only qualification that you need for social welfare service delivery. That's an old, outdated notion. We need to understand that the kinds of services that our people need does not necessarily demand social welfare service workers doing the service delivery. In this sense, ma'am, sample, we're talking about child and youth care workers. We're talking about auxiliary workers, we're talking about community development workers, work staff or staff of a workforce that do not have a necessarily expensive four-year qualification. We're not saying that we should stop social work because of being trained. We are saying that they have a specific role, they're very necessary for particularly work and particular statutory and tertiary service delivery, but for community development work, we do not need somebody that's 4 year qualified. We need somebody that has been on the job trained at an NGO that receives continued development education so that person does have a career path. But we are definitely saying we need to seriously invest in other models to be able to deliver the services that our people need on the ground. I think those were the questions, so I don't think I left out anything else.
Now, obviously, as Ms. Sample correctly said, we do not necessarily expect you to represent the government as such and answer all the questions. Some of the issues that obviously the researcher would be noting will come up in our engagement next week when we engage with the department. Well, On that note, may I express gratitude, I know you also under time pressure, for your input. Every year you come and you as in UNICEF, and you provide us a lot of food for thought, and we appreciate that. Lana, you wanted to say something? All right. Okay. We're going to proceed to the last presentation, and that's from the Child Institute. And that would lead us towards the end of our meeting. Pula, the stage is yours. Come and shine.
Thank you for the impromptu opportunity. We didn't plan to present, so I'm only going to present very quickly and give you some tidbits as to what's in the new South African child gauge and particularly how that relates to the budget. The child gauge that I've given you is our third edition. It's produced by the Children's Institute at UCT every year, and we basically review South Africa's progress in realizing children's rights. The first edition was on HIV, the second was on poverty, and this one is on children's social welfare services, which is basically what this committee is most concerned about and relates all the way back to the Children's Act, because the Children's Act is all about children's social services. Part one of the book looks at legislative developments for children over 2007. And last year was quite a bumper year for children and law. This committee passed the Children's Amendment Bill, and the Education Committee passed Education Laws Amendment Bill. There was also the Sexual Offences Bill, and Cabinet approved the Child Justice Bill for tabling. So quite a bumper year for children. And what we've done is analysed how these different laws fit together. And an example is that while the Sexual Offences Bill doesn't provide for any counselling for children who are victims of sexual assault, the Children's Bill does. So, whereas you can see a gap in the one law, luckily the Children's Bill in the prevention chapter has addressed that gap. The Education Laws Amendment Bill provides for drug testing of children in schools. Now, if we don't want to have drug testing and children expelled, we want to have drug testing and children referred to support services, and that's again where this committee comes in, because the Children's Bill provides for those referral services for children with drug problems, as does the bill that you're going to look at this year, the Substance Prevention and Management of Substance Abuse Bill. So the bills are very complementary, and if we can make all these five pieces of legislation work together, we really are moving towards a comprehensive set of child protection and care programs. Part two of the book looks at the right to social services, and when we talk about the right to social services, we're talking about welfare services, not education and health and social assistance, but the social services that are all regulated in the Children's Act. And part two looks at what this right means, what the Constitution says the right means, and we look at what the Children's Act does. And the Children's Act is a fantastic law because it does provide the legal foundation to give effect to that right. So in the book we celebrate the Children's Act and all the pioneering features, particularly the preventative, the focus on prevention services in that act. Then we look at some of the implementation challenges that face South Africa in now implementing that act. And in particular we look at human resources and then at the budget. And talk about some of the problems that will need to be addressed to ensure that the act can be implemented. Part three of the book is about statistics and children's access to socioeconomic benefits. And in that section we use government data sets, so the October Household Surveys and Stats SA sets, but we mine them for child-specific data, because when the general household surveys come out, they don't provide disaggregated data for children. So we use our own actuarial scientists to actually mine it for child-specific data. And we give you stats on children's access to water, housing, education, sanitation, electricity, healthcare, and social assistance. We also give you basic demographics like the number of orphans, the proportion of children, the number of child-headed households, HIV prevalence amongst children as well. And on the positive side, there's an interesting trend where you'll see a decrease in child hunger. We've tracked stats from 2002 to 2006, and whereas in 2002 you had 29% of children experiencing hunger, that's now gone down to 16% in 2006. So a positive trend. There are negative and positives. Mostly we've seen stabilizing trends or some improved trends for children. And And the interesting thing about that hunger decrease is that you can actually tie it to the child support grant. And the Department of Social Development's own commissioned research shows that the child support grant is playing a major role in reducing child hunger. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on part two, because that's where the budget information is. As I've said before, the passage of the Children's Act and the Children's Amendment Bill by this committee has provided the foundation that we can use to grow social services for children. The biggest challenge, though, is human resources. The biggest challenge is human resources. And as Professor September has pointed out, everyone seems to concentrate on social workers, but it's not about social workers. Yes, there is a critical shortage of social workers, and we need to worry about that, and we need to address it. But if you look at the Department of Social Development's plans, they already have social workers on their radar, and they have a retention strategy and a development strategy, and they're working on social workers. There's scholarships, there's bursaries, there's quite a big program there. But when you look at the other categories of workers, child and youth care workers, who are as important, if not more important, than social workers, because they are the ones who live in the community, deliver services in the community, come from the community. They tend to be young people and women who are trained on the job. They're linked to expanded public works programs as well. And as are the ECD workers. We have 55,000 ECD practitioners out there. Again, tend to be young people and women. Also linked to expanded public works. So if we're looking at increasing employment for young people and women, concentrating on developing and recognizing child and youth care workers and ECD practitioners is something that we need to see more attention paid to. And your committee will be looking this year at the Social Service Professions Council Amendment Bill. Well, not this year, next year.
We had a process of prioritization.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was draft gazetted comment earlier this year. And if you drill down to the major problem facing these other categories of workers, is that the council is dominated by one profession. So the council consists mainly of social workers. And there's competition. There's this feeling amongst the workers that there's not enough people to fill all the different roles. And so there's sometimes blockages and barriers put in the way for child and youth care workers and other categories of workers. And I think we need to ensure that council is representative of the workers that need to be developed. So we need child and youth care workers, ECD practitioners, and community development workers on the council to ensure that those other categories can also be advanced. So I think when you get that bill next year, that could do its attention. Now, turning to the budget, what we did is we compared what the costing report for the Children's Act said the Children's Act would cost to what the provincial DSDs have allocated for the 2009 and 2010 year. The analysis in that book looks at the 2007 NTEF, and we're busy doing the 2008, because the provincial budgets have just come out now, so we'll do the same thing for this year as well. And what it shows is that the provincial departments of social development need at least $5 billion for next year, that's 2009-10, to implement the Act. But they've only allocated $1.7 billion. So there's a difference of about $3.3 billion between what the costing says you need for the lowest implementation drive and what the DSDs have allocated. And we must remember that the lowest scenario by DSD meets under 30% of the need. So only 30% of the orphans and the childhood households and the children of being abused will be met by $5 billion, and we haven't even budgeted for $5 billion. We've only budgeted for 1.7. If you look at the more higher scenarios, the high cost scenario says we should have R42 billion for next year, versus R1.7 billion, and that's a difference of R40 billion. And that high scenario was aimed at ensuring equality across the provinces and equal services and access for all children. And we point to a number of reasons why there's this low budget allocation and low budget expenditure. And the first problem is that the equitable share doesn't include social services for children in the formula. So whereas you've got a strong representation for education and health in the equitable share formula, there's no specific component for social services. Now, the Financial and Fiscal Commission has been warning Treasury to amend this for since 2006, because the Financial and Fiscal Commission saw that this committee had passed the Older Persons Bill, the Children's Bill, that Justice was about to pass the Child Justice Bill, and that all these pieces of legislation would increase the obligations on the provinces to implement social services. And they said to Treasury, you need to be giving more money to the provinces to meet these legislative obligations. And Treasury is now, at the moment, amending that equitable share formula. And maybe this committee wants to think about actually calling in Treasury to ask them about how they're going to ensure that social services, particularly the legislation that you've passed, is appropriately costed and included in that equitable share. Then the second problem is that when the provinces get their lump sum from Treasury and the provincial treasuries make the decision as to how much goes to each department, the provincial departments of social development face many barriers. Their first barrier is that they tend to have under-expended every year because they have a lack of capacity to spend. And so when they go and ask for more money, they are told, you didn't spend last year, we're not giving you more. And that's a valid argument in a way. They also lack the capacity to bid for money. So they're not very good at submitting good business plans to actually get that money from their provincial treasuries. Within the bidding process, the department is very low on the priority list. It's also very low in the political arena. Education and health are much stronger, as is justice and all the other areas. So BSD needs some affirmative action. There's also a general lack of knowledge at both a national level and a provincial level of Section 214 in the Constitution. Section 214 lists a number of factors that should be taken into account when budget decisions are made. And the important one for Parliament is that it says obligations imposed by national legislation must be taken into account in the budgeting process. And we see time and time again that when you talk to economists at Treasury, or even the provincial officials involved in making these budget decisions, they don't use legislation and the obligations that have been imposed by legislation to influence the decision-making around budgets. It's mainly based on past expenditure and the capacity of the province or the department to deliver, which is based on inequitable allocations, because it's the provinces that have got facilities and social workers that get more money in a way. And Black Sash mentioned earlier the problem that Parliament can't amend budgets. That's the problem with Section 77 in the Constitution. But what we need to look at is that Parliament can affect budgets in another way, and that's by passing laws. So when Parliament enacted the Social Assistance Act, which said that old people must get pensions, that resulted in a shift of 20 billion rand in the budget. Okay, so if Parliament says the MEC must provide child and youth care centres for children in need of care, that results in a 500 million rand budget shift. So that's the biggest way that Parliament can actually make money move, is by putting in strong provisioning clauses into your laws, and the Children's Act has done that fantastically. The interesting area is the Social Assistance Act around the child support grant age. So whereas the age for the old age pensions is set in the Social Assistance Act by Parliament, the age for the child support grant is delegated to the Minister, together with Treasury, to make that decision. And I think that the question to pose here is, who should be making such a big decision? This decision as to whether the grant stops at 14 or 18 affects 2.5 million children. It affects their rights to nutrition, social assistance, education, healthcare, and it's an amount of 5.4 billion rand a year. So it's a very big decision. And what's happening at the moment, if you get down to the bare bones, is that Treasury, in essence, is making that decision. The Department of Social Development has made its decision, and it's bidding in cabinet all the time to get it extended to 18. But Treasury is blocking it. And the question I want to leave you with is, should that decision be made by the executive and one department at that, or should that decision be made by Parliament? It's such a big decision that affects such a large amount of children's rights. Why is that decision being made in that way? And the basic problem seems to be that where Parliament is transparent and democratic and participatory and ensures that the people's voices can be heard, the process for regulation making is done behind closed doors. It's not transparent, it's not participatory. And so important decisions like how much water is in the free basic water allocation, is it 50 litres or is it 25 kilolitres? Who makes that decision? Simply with the transport grant, it's been relegated to the executive. And civil society's problem with that is that we don't get heard. Organisations like BlackSash, who are working with clients every day, can't get their message through because the executive doesn't dialogue. So we would prefer those big decisions about budgets to be made by Parliament. So there's just some little bits of information that about what's in the book, but you can read the book for more. Thanks.
Thank you very much. A lot of food for thought. I can indicate that insofar as policy is concerned, the Constitution does say that the executive makes policy and that we make law. But then, of course, what is policy? What is law? Because the bills are proposed by the executive. They come to us. They are a legal form of policy. Policy that has a force of law, basically. Do we here come and rewrite policy in the process or in the course of developing legislation? It's a conundrum which will never be resolved. It's the what do you call it, the Maccabi dance or something. I think that the costing that you've done, we're going to be very interested in the methodology of what you've used and how reliable it is, how much we can rely on that, because that is one of the subjects of contestation, where we are accused as a committee for having inflated the budget for the implementation of the Children's Act by bringing in stuff that's increased the cost through our own amendments to the bills that were put to us. But certainly an amount of 5,000 rands, 5 billion, sorry, seems to be something that can be possibly managed. I can't remember what the Treasury quoted the law cost at 7 billion last year. What did they say in their presentation? Anybody remembers? Because they came to do a presentation on costing as well. Maybe we should go back to those notes and check what they actually told us. And in fact, they also confirmed that the issue is not about money. The issue is about the capacity to bid, and it's about the capacity to spend. So you've, in a sense, confirmed what has already been articulated by Treasury. We certainly will need to go back to that with Treasury in preparation for what we hope this time in the parliamentary program allows, to go back to the provinces and sit with each province and say, since the removal of social assistance from your load of responsibilities, what have you done to increase your capacity to provide welfare services? Because that was the whole intention.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Apart from making social assistance more efficiently administered centrally, but the other major intention was to create the space for provinces to be able to grow their own capacity to. So we will come back to that. Members, it's open for discussion. Anybody with any comments or questions? That would be All right. Okay. That seems to have been fairly clear. I'm not sure whether people are tired or whether it's fine that we've reached this point in the day. All right. Let me then thank all the presenters for wonderful, wonderful input. I think that we'll collate all this and reduce it to a set of questions for our research unit that we would present to the department. While Lana is here, I had hoped that maybe more senior officials from the department would have been here so that they can hear for themselves what civil society has to say about their budget for that next week when we engage them. But I know Lana is a very good messenger. She will convey some of the issues. But on our side, I think we'd want before Wednesday. When are we engaging them? Is it Wednesday and Thursday?
Wednesday and Thursday.
Wednesday and Thursday, because Tuesday we thought that members might want to use the day to travel, otherwise we might start late because
Home Affairs,
yeah. But also that Monday is Easter Monday. So we really would urge members to do their best. I know it would be immediately after Easter to be here so that we can dispose of the budget and then move on to legislation. We have real serious time pressures. I don't know what's going to happen to the program, but we'll come to a brief discussion on the program of the committee. On that note, thank you very much. This concludes our deliberations on civil society engagement with the vote. What is it called? Vote 17. 16. Does it keep on shifting every year? All right. So we vote 16 this year. All right. The other matter we thought we would use the balance of the time for, and the intention is not to keep you, relates to the program of the committee. We as the management committee have adopted a program which is fairly similar to the one that we presented last time. We did present the program last time. We just made some adjustments that we can discuss. Now, essentially, the framework we're proposing is that this week and next week be dedicated to finalizing the budget and strat plan of the department and the two agencies, NDA and SASA. We're then proposing that we go into recess in April, during which period we do not know whether some of us will be engaged in the IPU process and to what extent. The IPU is from the 10th to the 18th, so we assume that some of us may be called in to be involved there, but otherwise it would be a constituency period. We had hoped, we're still hoping, to then have a week's break from the 18th, which would otherwise have been the date on which we'd be departing for our overseas trip if we had stuck to original 2 weeks. As you'd remember, we've reduced it to 1 week. So the week of following the 18th would be a break and people could be able to go back to their constituencies for a week. And then Friday the 25th of April, we hoped to be the day when we depart for our overseas trip. Returning the following Friday the 2nd of May, and obviously people finally arriving Saturday, Sunday, the 4th of May. The parliamentary program would then resume after that recess, April recess, on the first week of May, which starts on the 5th, so the 6th would be the first day, and our assumption is that that would be a committee period. People would be fresh from overseas and would be going straight into public hearings. So we thought that first week we could have hearings here in Cape Town, as is customary. And then the following week, the second week of May, we thought that we could use that week to pursue our idea of having the community participation exercise that we discussed previously, where we go to communities that are affected and hear their input. That the third week would be dedicated to a multi-departmental briefing exercise, where we would also be asking departments to respond to some of the issues that would have come out of the public engagement that would have happened in the first 2 weeks of May. So that would be the third week with the different departments. We've had the DSD, even though they presented informally, was it week before last? Right. So, and then we would then on the so that would be the third week. The fourth week, what would?
Purpose of the public comments and input by other departments.
Yes. What would then be doing on the fourth week would then be to collate all that information that would have come through the first 3 weeks, and engaging the department now, social development, going through the bill and going through the comments, you know, the traditional way we do it. And of course, in the process, issuing instructions to them with regard to any amendments that may need to be effected to the bill. Then that obviously would be concluding the month of May. So every week has a specific